welcome to Center Maryland's The Lobby Pod. We have a special guest with us today from right outside the nation's capital. She has been a member of the Maryland General Assembly for as long as I've ever been down there. And you would never know it by talking with her that she is the vice chair of the Education, Energy, and Environment Committee in the Senate of Maryland. She represents District 17 in Montgomery County, which, you know, is Rockville and Gaithersburg, probably one of the most populous places in the state. And we're very excited to have Senator Cheryl Kagan with us here today. Senator Kagan, thanks so much for coming by the Center Maryland Lobby Pod.
I'm delighted to be with you, Damian. Seems like turnabout is fair play since you were kind enough to be a guest on my podcast, Kibitzing with Kagan.
Well, that was very kind of you, and we're not used to the video format, so I apologize to your listeners for looking like a wild man from West Baltimore or something, but hopefully they'll get a few smiles out of it at least.
Definitely.
So, Senator Kagan, we've been in Lexington Market together. You are no stranger to Baltimore. I always remember first seeing you sort of behind Mayor Martin O'Malley way back in 1999. Yeah. I remember you being in Baltimore then. I remember when I was interning in the legislature, you were one of the sharpest minds on the House side. And I think I was only there for several years and moved on before you got into the Senate. How long have you been doing this?
So thank you. It's very kind. I served 8 years in the House, and after 9/11, after September 11th, I was wondering whether it was the best use of my time. And some folks were inspired to join the military or make other life changes. I decided not to seek re-election, even though I had money in the bank and no opposition. Ultimately, I was out for 12 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty unusual. And then when Jenny Forehand, my predecessor, decided to retire after 36 years in office, which is a long time, it was suggested that I run. And my House successor thought that he was the obvious next senator. And there were a lot of people who disagreed with that idea and asked me to run. So that was 9 years ago now.
I really think the Senate of Maryland is a unique perch for a Montgomery County citizen to serve upon. And, you know, we've seen all the greats, not just you, but Stuart Badum, right? And Larry Levitan, and you said Jenny Forehand, Ida Rubin, you know, we could go on and on. What's
Can we
interesting,
just say Jamie Raskin? I mean, Jamie, let's talk about.
How about for the modern era, right?
How about Brian Frosch? How about, I think. Brian Feldman, my chair, fantastic. Yeah, we've got a lot of talent around the state, you know.
But let me be a little pointed at this, because, and then again, this could be just my Baltimore perspective coming up in Baltimore politics. But your citizenry in Montgomery County has got to be one of the smartest, wealthiest, most engaged, compassionate. I mean, it's got to be like superlative city if. You know, super engaged. This is sort of my view, right? From the city Senate delegation, if you will. But so go ahead.
Yeah, no. So it used to be that everybody thought Montgomery County was rich, white people, right, and the streets are paved with gold. And Montgomery County, I'm a native. I grew up here, left to go to college, came back to do politics and policy at the national level and then at the state level. But we are increasingly diverse, ethnically, economically, linguistically, in terms of all ways. And it's very exciting. Gaithersburg and Rockville, my district, are two of the most linguistically diverse cities in the country.
Wow.
So I love the opportunity to speak in foreign languages and to learn, to go out to restaurants at different kind of cuisines, and to engage in the variety of communities that I'm honored to represent.
It's a special place. And as an elected official, though, be it in the state Senate, you know, it's like you've got the super engaged electorate, We saw that in the governor's race, where your voice was so important for Governor Moore. But, you know, I always sort of felt like the Senate is the greatest place ever for a Montgomery County elected official, because they're super focused on the local government, right? They're also super focused on the federal government. It's right there. They're on the doorstep. So Rockville and the nation's capital are actually closer to them than their own state capital. And so you're on sort of a special mission for these very smart people. They send you all the way to Annapolis. and they, you know, it's not sort of in their immediate sphere of experience. They've got other pressures, the national stuff, the local stuff. So it just seems to me to be a pretty unique place for them to send you.
Right. So first off, you mentioned Westmore, Governor Westmore. So I have to just say, I was the first legislator outside of Baltimore City to endorse Westmore in a 12-way race when he was at 1% in the polls. And as a white Jewish woman senator from Montgomery County, it was seen as a pretty big risk. And what if this one, that one, and the other one gets elected? You're going to be, you know, out in the cold. And I said, he's the guy. Westmore is the guy.
I saw it from far away, and I was like, that's, again, courageous, and especially coming from where you're coming from. You have 100 other things you could do. You know, you got a great guy, Tom Perez, running around your county like nobody else. You know, you were really a bulwark for that campaign.
Thank you. And John King and Ashwani Jane and Doug Gansler and our comptroller, and there were a lot of good candidates, but I had 3 criteria, and Westmore was the only one who met them. But let me go back to the engaged citizenry. There is in Montgomery County much more of a focus generally on federal government. They are focused on, you know, Speaker McCarthy and is the government going to shut down and what's happening with the continuing resolution. And they're all insiders and they're brilliant policy experts in some parts of our county. And then there are people who are average people, and they just are working and supporting their families and going to schools and, you know, engaged in their community, and they're working at their small business or nonprofit and just being good, engaged citizens. And they don't generally have a hyper focus on what we do in Annapolis. And it feels like part of my job is to educate them. And so I send out weekly emails, blast emails during the legislative session saying, here's what we're working on. Tell me what you think. And here's what I'm doing.
And you might have the best multi-channel experience for constituents in the whole state. I mean, if you call your phone, you help link them back to some of the other online resources. If you go online, they're linked. You've got video content. You've got all kinds of tools to communicate with your very savvy electorate.
Thank you. Well, I have 5 Facebook pages, 4 Twitter accounts, 2 YouTube channels, and an Instagram page. And I tell my staff when I'm interviewing folks is that no one has any of the passwords but me. I run all my own social. And so if they're getting something, if they see it on Twitter or X or Facebook or Instagram or something, it's me. And so they get my authentic voice. For whatever that's worth.
That's right. There's no interference with your signal. One other special thing that I'd like to talk about is that I get to do state and local politics in a couple different states across the country, as you have done in your career. You know, you find sometimes a state senator, maybe an expert in a particular issue, right? That's quite common. But you are perceived to be, or you are, I think, and others think, a national expert in 2 very important areas. One, the 911 system and emergency management around those communications. And then the other is elections, which is like the emergency management of democracy. Yeah. And I just wonder, how did you get to become an expert in 2 fields like that? Now, I'm not just saying like an expert like your Maryland legislators rely on you for a little inside intel. But what I'm telling the audience is people around the country rely on your experience to help them guide towards reform. And I just love to hear, how does that happen?
Well, that's generous. Thank you. So 911 was quite unintentional. I had a constituent, a friend, an activist named Carl Henn, who was at a one-year celebration event for a community garden that he set up in Rockville. And there was a freak thunderstorm. He was struck by lightning, and 911 was overloaded. And people were dialing and getting busy signals and couldn't get through. And finally, someone threw him into their truck where they and took him to the hospital, where he later died. And it was during my 12-year gap out of office. And I said, if I'm ever back in office again, I'm going to do something in Carl's memory to make sure that no other family has this experience. He left a wife and two young daughters. And so we have passed 13 laws now. I chaired a statewide commission for 4 years that really has been at the forefront nationally. And other states have followed our lead. It was everything from
what was going wrong that what was generally going in wrong in the system that you were able to, you know, reform.
So the biggest challenges tend to be funding and staffing. But there's also technology. We have to watch out on cybersecurity and oversight and make sure all of that is going correctly. But if you don't have a 911 specialist, as we renamed them in law, they are not call takers. They are not dispatchers. These are the courageous women and men under the headset who save lives every day. And if your baby isn't breathing, if your house is literally burning down, or you've just been raped, you need to be able to call 911 and have them send you police, fire, or paramedics to help address your crisis. And if we don't have the right people with the right equipment, we can have the very best firefighters, the very best police and paramedics, and it's for naught. They're not going to get the help they need in a timely manner. And more we're hearing stories of people being put on hold for 15 minutes or getting voicemail. And that's because it's a really hard job. And we've got to get people under the headsets to help at our 911 centers.
Yeah, this is a time for me to give a public apology. I just went through this, was on the phone because my kid had my 10-year-old had a big event that occurred, and I got on the phone and I'm like with the 911 person, who was amazing. Dispatcher's amazing.
I'm so glad.
But wonderful. But I felt like I was the worst conceivable dad on the phone and spazzing out.
But that's what everybody does. It's the worst day of their lives.
Yeah.
They don't know what to do. And the person under the headset has to stay calm, has to be able to talk them through what to do. There's a story, there's a woman I've worked with on 911 stuff, and I'm going to do the disclaimer alert. If you're easily like freaked out, seriously stop listening now for a minute while I tell this story. There was a woman who called in because she came home to her house to find her daughter hanging, suicide. And obviously she's freaking out, and the woman had to try to, the 911 specialist had to help her, coach her on how to try to cut down her daughter's body.
Save her, right? Yeah.
She couldn't do it. And then she said, okay, you need to take her legs and hold her up to get the pressure off her neck. And she did. And the 911 specialist stayed on the phone. I can't. She's too heavy. We're moms. We're strong. We can do this. And she kept holding on. In the meantime, obviously paramedics were dispatched right away. The short story, it had a happy ending, which is they got there and the young woman survived. And so talk about just a trauma. And then you hang up on that call, and the next call, you just never know what the next call is going to be.
Wow.
Right? Powerful. Wow. And these people have PTSD, they have depression, they have obesity, they have huge challenges, and they're among the most important community service employees we have. And we don't thank them, we don't recognize them, we don't pay or benefit them enough. And without them, that young woman would have died. The house is burned down. The baby dies. I mean, it's horrible. The bad guy gets away in a crime.
And those stories kept you going.
Oh, all the
I mean, 4 years of, you know, serving on a chair of a committee is no small feat.
I had to quit my part-time job because my 911 stuff took so much time. We had four subcommittees that I created. We had 1 hour meetings in each of them, plus a steering committee of all the four other chairs and stuff each week. So it's 5 hours plus the prep and the blah, blah. It was a lot, but you know what? It's literally saving lives. And I have to give a shout out to my former Senate colleague, Republican Ed Riley, a wonderful senator. We disagree on tons of stuff, but he was a devoted partner and loyal ally on all things 911. And he thanked me for choosing him as the Republican senator on this commission, because he said it's literally life or death, and it is the most important service that government provides.
I mean, you know, like I said, I'm a dad, couldn't even do the phone call. I can't imagine four mm-hmm. years of it. Right? So, how about elections? Elections is one of the titles of your committee.
Yep.
I recall as a young lawyer there, that being sort of a central focus every year. George Della bills, I remember. I bet you come at it with a little differently.
George Della, who was defeated by Bill Ferguson, who is now our fabulous president of the Senate.
That's right.
Mr. 46 has a great legacy here. So elections, it's a little bit of a pet peeve because elections are not in the name of our committee as I think it should be. As you said, it's education, energy, and environment. And I always say, and elections.
That's right. Thank you.
Four E's, as I call it, E quad, or rather than triple E or EEE. But elections are the backbone of our democracy. So if 911 is the backbone of our public safety system, then elections are the backbone of our democracy. And in recent years, and I'm not trying to be partisan, I'm a proud Democrat, but I'm not trying to be partisan when I say that Donald Trump has changed the culture and the attitude towards our elections. There have been increased numbers of threats against election officials, doubts, attacks, hack efforts, disinformation, misinformation, fake electors, the efforts, obviously, on January 6th, and again, bless Jamie Raskin.
Amen.
May he live long and be healthy for decades to come, because we need him in America and in Congress. But there are challenges to our electoral system, unlike any in our history. And technology has allowed us to move forward with mail-in ballots, with how we process ballots, how transparent it can be. All of that is good, but we need to make sure that we maintain public trust. And so whether it's about transparency efforts that I've been working with Delegate, now Chairman Mark Corman, whether it's about increasing the speed of our canvassing and counting of mail-in ballots, they're how we do recounts, campaign finance, there are a lot of pieces to election law. And last year I had 8 bills, and it keeps me busy.
Those are two big areas that I would say the public sees you as a verified expert, thought leader, as we would say in our business. Mm-hmm. And after seeing how you operate your business, I'm just glad you are in the public sector, because I would, if you were in the private sector with you, I'd want you on my team.
Thank you.
You have an incredibly structured, fastidious approach to things. I'll get into this. Sure. Yeah.
I just say there's a third area that's another passion,
That's what I meant to ask you. So go ahead, please.
Yeah. So I'm often described as the senator for the nonprofit sector.
Cool.
So I have been a founder, a director, a funder, a board member, a volunteer, like I've done all that. And so often we say and we hear, we've got to do something to help our small businesses. I agree, but it should be our small businesses and nonprofits, because without our food pantries and battered women's shelters and homeless shelters and literacy councils and arts and humanities organizations, our community would be the worse for it. And either we would be suffering and not helping folks, or government would have to pick up the slack, which would mean tax increases for everyone, because people still need to be housed and protected and educated. And the nonprofit sector is critically important. So I have, a few years ago, I established a national legislative caucus, and have been working with the National Council of Nonprofits, pulling together sort of best of legislation. What did they pass in Montana or Connecticut or Alabama that right. might be interesting in Maryland? And then bragging about the laws that we've passed here in Maryland that I've sponsored over the years and that others have, and let others learn from them.
And so really, Maryland's kind of a nonprofit mecca in the sense, I know Baltimore is sort of a city of nonprofits. And then I would imagine because of the proximity to the Capitol, there would be a whole nother set, you know, sort of related to that sphere. It just seems like a very special area of the state that needs maybe more attention and focus. That's what you're bringing it?
100%. So, for instance, in 2022, we enacted a law that said, let's repay our small businesses faster. So if they get a contract or something, we were taking too long. Government was taking too long to pay them back. I had a bill that passed the Senate unanimously, but it took an extra year to get it passed for nonprofits. And I literally had a witness come in and testify that she had to take a second mortgage on her personal home in order to make payroll because government was so delayed in paying off the grant or contract that she had earned for her nonprofit. That's disrespectful. It's not helpful. We can do better. And Comptroller Brooke Learman and I worked together to come up with legislation that would work well and support our nonprofits. We've done several other bills as well.
Washington Jewish Week?
Yes.
Cover picture, cover story.
How crazy.
About Senator Kagan. Wasn't really about the elections. Mm-mm. Wasn't too much about 911. It was about something else.
Yeah.
It wasn't even about nonprofits. It was about something else.
No, it was all about my music. So on a side note, I was when I was in the House for 8 years, I was the House's representative on the Maryland State Arts Council. And President Ferguson just appointed me as the Senate's representative on the Maryland State Arts Council. So I'm proud to be an advocate statewide. But since 2003, I have had my own concert series that I've hosted called Folk and Great Music. And I host national touring singer-songwriters in my home generally, although I have also done it in other larger venues. And 100% of the money comes in, the suggested minimum donation goes to the performers to allow them to have a successful career.
There ain't nothing like supporting the arts. So I just want to thank you for that. And I don't think people understand, you know, they may think musicians are sort of famous or not, you know, and there's the whole culture of professional and amateur musicians that are everywhere on that spectrum and could use all different levels of support, right?
Yes. So if playing, so I used to be able to get about 75 people in my basement, in my old house, that was a grown-up house. And now I can still get 45, 50 people in my living room. And with everybody paying 20, 25 bucks, some people throw in more, the performer goes home with a good number of dollars.
Right. It's outstanding value for the listener.
Yep.
No ticket master.
Yes. Dear God. Right. Right. And it, as I said, it all goes to the performer and they're so grateful. And I never took a cut of CD sales. I mean, it's all about an intimate listening center opportunity. And if I can get somebody to join me one time for a concert, they sign up for virtually every one that their schedule permits because they've never heard of this person. But if I'm presenting them, they know they're awesome.
Right.
Yeah.
And you have all kinds of luminaries that pop in throughout the years. But let me tell you this, my partner, Steve, and I have dreamed about doing this in Baltimore and we just got it underway in our own way after talking about it forever. You're a person that has a dream or a thought in their head And you must be highly selective about which ones you pursue, because when you go after one of these things, whether it's elections, whether it's any of these nonprofits, you're gonna go after it like nothing I've ever seen. And we dreamed about it, we talk about it. You did it and you're doing it since 2003. That's 20 years of sort of organizing enjoyment for others. You know, your legislative career has been long, your public service career has been long. It's just, but what strikes me about it is the structure. So I got a little question, and to me, a guy from Mount St. Joe in West Baltimore and Ellicott City and all that, Vassar was not like in the lexicon where I come from. And I just wonder, I know plenty of people from Montgomery County. I know plenty of elected officials. I know some fired up female leaders like no other. But is there something about that Vassar education that gives you that structure? Where did that structure and follow through come from?
That's a really hard question to answer. I don't know how much of it was.
Yeah, you're different than us. That's like your superpower.
Nature versus nurture. I don't know. So Vassar is a small liberal arts school. A lot of people remember it as Fancy Society Women, and it used to be all women until 1969. Jackie Kennedy went there, Jane Fonda, Jackie Bouvier, but Jane Fonda. We had Meryl Streep graduated from there. I mean, we had a lot of famous folks.
I just think extraordinary literate. Like in my when I hear, and then I think of your Scrabble. When I think of Vassar, I think like extraordinarily literate, like the elite, you know, in that space.
Well, at Vassar, first semester, freshman year, this is actually a cute story, I think. I always thought I was a moderate. I'm for peace and freedom and justice and equality and fairness and just obvious values, right? And I learned first semester, freshman year, political science 105 with Richard Bourne, I learned that I was a liberal. And so I said, well, if I'm a liberal, I ought to do something about it. And I was going to major in foreign languages. And I ended up taking the T2 bus from my mother's house down to DuPont Circle in DC and volunteering on a presidential campaign for Ted Kennedy. And
really?
That's how it all started.
So that was 80
years ago, 1980.
What a campaign to be a part of.
Yeah, I was on the floor of the Democratic Convention the night of his Sail Against the Wind speech. And it was life changing. And and when I was 18, I thought one day maybe I'd run for office. And then I grew out of it and somehow was talked into it. And so
what do you think would have happened if you went with a winning campaign? So who's was Jimmy Carter? Let's say you did something different. You got sent over to work with like Anita Dunn or something over there with Jimmy Carter. How would that have changed your political perspective, do you think? Because, I mean, Ted Kennedy, 1980, is zeitgeist. I mean, you feel it in your heart, right?
Right. So I worked at the national level for a long time. I was very, very proud. One of the coolest things I've ever done was I was one of the lobbyists with Jim and Sarah Brady that passed the Brady Bill, which was a 7-day waiting period before getting a handgun, and also did the assault weapons ban that lived for 10 years and then expired. And the late U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein was the key leader there. Joe Biden, now President of the United States, his office was critically important in passing the Brady Bill. So I worked on that. I worked at National NARAL, protecting women's abortion rights. I ran a national progressive PAC called Independent Action that supported progressive pro-choice challengers running for Congress. So I did a lot at the national level and also worked for four different direct mail firms. So I've done a lot of campaign related as well as legislative work prior to my running.
That's where that eye comes from there, your direct mail days.
There's that. Yeah. And it was a 10-way race with two incumbents and eight of us going for the third seat. And I just said, I'm going to have to out hustle and out door knock and have the best mail and the best volunteers. And the voters chose me.
That's anything replaced with door knocking. Like we all see, you know, everybody online taking pictures of themselves when they're out there door knocking. Is that the still one of the sort of premier ways to get information from your constituents?
Yes. And this is so I go to events year round and people stop me in the grocery store, at the library, in a park, at a community event. And I try to be as accessible and open to hearing agreement, disagreement, suggestions. I was at the gym once and a guy I totally didn't know came up to me and thanked me for sponsoring the styrofoam ban. I was like, not only did he know who I was, but he knew like part of my legislative agenda. So through social media, through my emails, through the work that I do, through podcasts like this, I try to get the word out. Because I haven't had a primary or a general election opponent, since I was elected to the Senate, it's kind of hard to rationalize giving up nights and weekends over and over to knock on doors all the time. But I do hear from voters in so many other ways, and I appreciate that.
That's because nobody wants to work that hard to take you on. I mean, no, even in that district, it's probably got all the hardest working people.
Now. It's a great district. I have to give a shout out to my House colleagues. So Delegate Kumar Barve just resigned. A legend. And I supported him when he first was elected in 1990. He's now in the Public Service Commission and brings a great deal of expertise. And then we have Julie Palacios.
That's a humor, I would say. Right? Yes. Right. Rare yes. sense of humor.
Yes, Kumar the Magnificent. So Delegate Julie Palacovic Carr, very thoughtful, smart, well-respected, progressive. Joe Vogel, who was just elected.
He's got the fever, right? He's going
he's
for
got
Congress
a lot of,
now?
Yeah, he's running for Congress to succeed David Trone. And I don't know if that'll work for him, but he's doing great work in the House. And then my new delegate, former Gaithersburg City Council member, Ryan Spiegel, who's going to just be rock star. And he's on That's appropriations. Right. So District 17 is.
And he's a real savvy transportation. I mean, I guess you got to be if you're in your district. If you're not for transportation solutions, you know, you're 100%. Not going to have awfully nice conversations at the gym.
That's right. My district runs up 270 or up the Metro Red Line, up the high tech corridor. I describe it a lot of different ways, but transportation is critically important for economic development and for people getting to work, getting to sightsee, getting to enjoy the arts. So that is important. And Metro is important and needs funding and attention. Always.
Last question. You know, I'm holding you longer than I promised, but I'd love if you could just, you know, your view from the capital of the most populous county in Maryland, looking at Annapolis as the session begins to creep up. Your friend Westmore is going to have his sophomore session.
Yes.
What do you see on the horizon? What should we be looking for trend wise or of interest from your perch?
So Governor Westmore and the Moore Miller administration, Lieutenant Governor Aruna Miller, I want to give a shout out to the Moore Miller administration's cabinet. I have spent this summer having podcast interviews, conversations with over and over and over these supremely talented, experienced cabinet secretaries who are passionate about serving. And Governor Moore has been talking about this is Maryland's decade. I have complete confidence that it will be that, because Secretary Kevin Anderson with the Commerce Department is out there recruiting jobs and businesses, opportunities, nonprofits to come to Maryland. And Secretary McElwain on the environment and working towards climate change, and Secretary Flora on the planning department. And she's so focused on making us smart growth. And Secretary Jake Day on housing and community development and making sure that we're looking out for those who are struggling and making sure that they've got clean, safe, affordable places to live. Secretary Kevin Addicks and Ag Department and improving our access to and supporting our farmers while also balancing the environment. Tony Woods, Secretary Woods, the Veterans Department, cleaning up things in where things have been overlooked in our for our, those who have served our country. I could go on. There are so many, and each one of them, Secretary Paul Wiedefeld at the Transportation Department, who has to focus on BWI and Metro and our highways and all of the things. And he brings his incredible background and passion. So again, I could go on and on. Secretary Lopez in Department of Human Services, blah, blah, blah. They are all.
But you put them, all of them, on your all on your channels, right? Delivering those straight to your people.
Yep. They're on Apple Podcast as well as on my YouTube channel. So if folks are listening and want to subscribe, I'd be grateful to have them do that on Apple or YouTube. And there are more to come. And in addition to cabinet secretaries, I just did the chancellor of the University System of Maryland. I talked to the Anti-Defamation League about hate and anti-Semitism. I've talked to President Ferguson and Chair Feldman, so political people, nonprofit folks, about homelessness and food and security and the arts. My Scrabble. I have had podcasts about my work as a nationally ranked Scrabble player. I brought that to Maryland, the national championships. I brought it to Baltimore last year.
You're just going to slide that in at the end?
I have to slide that in. I got to bring in my Scrabble.
It's pretty awesome, isn't it?
It's so fun.
It's such a universal language, so to speak, you know. And thank you for making it happen in Baltimore. I mean, that's what I'm talking about here. Yes. Taking something from a little tile and turning it into an economic development experience in Baltimore. That's not easy to connect those things. That's what Cheryl Kagan does. We're grateful she's our state senator representing District 17. The great people of Gaithersburg and Rockville, Maryland. Senator, thanks so much for being on the show with us today.
This was so fun, Damian. Thanks for inviting me. It's been an honor.
We can't wait to have you back on Senator Maryland's The Lobby Pod.